I knew that everything I did 24 hours a day was being watched.
I'm MK Anderson, and this is First 100 Days. A podcast where we discuss the idea that if the first 100 days of a presidency are so important, they're likely to be important for anybody else's career and life moves. We'll talk to CEOs, first-time parents, startup bros, and more to discover if the first 100 days are really that important. Today, we're chatting with Justice Sheila O'Brien, who retired from the Illinois Appellate Court in 2011. You may know her as the person who successfully petitioned for a special prosecutor in the Jussie Smollett case, but I know her as my mom. In 1985, at just 29 years old, she was appointed the first female judge in St. Clair County in Illinois, and I'm so excited to speak with her about those first 100 days. But because not everyone is your daughter, how about you give us a quick look into your background as to what you thought you were going to do after undergrad?
Well, I'm one of five kids. Important in my life is all four of my grandparents were immigrants, and that really colored our life as a family. My dad was a police officer. My mom's a nurse. My dad didn't get to finish high school because he had to support his family. So working hard and becoming successful, at least, or more importantly, being able to take care of yourself was a big deal in our family. So I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, a very working-class neighborhood. I've gone to 22 years of Catholic education, which is kind of interesting. And I was lucky enough to be in the second class of women who were admitted to the undergraduate school at the University of Notre Dame, which was a wonderful experience and a wonderful place to be. And law school was pretty much always in the conversation. Our family really cared about the public conversation. They encouraged us to be active in what was going on in our community and to know who our elected officials were. So at our dinner table, we talked about baseball, because baseball was a big deal. We lived right outside of St. Louis, so we loved the Cardinals. Baseball and religion and politics. And we talked about those things all the time in long and big conversations and sometimes heated conversations. So being in public life and going to law school just seemed like a natural extension of how I was reared. Oh, so I went to law school, stayed at Notre Dame. Actually, it was not the place I wanted to stay, but I got into some other great places, but it was the cheapest place to go because I had a place to live off campus for $50 a month, and I could walk. And I had two jobs. I had one in the dining hall, and I had one at the Morris Inn, both food establishments, so I'd be able to have food. So it worked out that way. And I went to law school and got out of law school in 1980.
So did you like law school? The real
No.
Question that everyone wants to know.
No, I couldn't stand law school. It was not my finest hour. Law school's boot camp, essentially, and I really resented that. I resented how they treated us, and I didn't like it because I wanted to learn the information, and I had such compressed time to do it because I was working so much. So law school was really frustrating. I was not a great law student, but I knew I'd be a good lawyer. So you have to just kind of go through it and get it over with. Interestingly, most of the people who I know in the world who are very, very good lawyers and very successful were not great law students because they were ready to practice law. They didn't want to spend a lot of time in the Socratic method of teaching. So law school was, it was a drag. Yeah, it was a real drag. I didn't like it at all. But you got to do it to be a lawyer. I wish we were living back when Lincoln was alive and you could just work with a lawyer and become a lawyer. But
well, you know, that that's what Kim Kardashian is doing, right?
Yes. And, you know, you got to hand it to her. I think she's going to law school, though, too.
No, she's not. She's just working with lawyers in California.
Well, then I love that. That would make sense to me because you get context for it. So I did law school and really left law school and thought, I would like to be a backup singer because that's really what I wanted to do in life. And I honestly did. I thought I was going to move to California and be a backup singer. And I had no money. So I thought, well, maybe I'll home. I had him a phone to my parents, and I took the Illinois bar. My mother encouraged me to take the bar because she said, come this far, at least get licensed. I mean, I told them, I said, I'm done. I don't want to do this. So I took the bar and I passed it, and then I went home to live with them. And I still was going to pack up my stuff and go to California and work in the recording industry, hopefully, be a back singer. But I needed money, and so I got a job at the courthouse as a public defender. And I loved it, and it was great. I loved being in the courtroom. It's kind of like being on stage, so it was a lot of fun.
And how long did you end up being a public defender?
Well, that's a good question. I was a public defender what seems like not a long time, but in smaller communities, when you are a licensed attorney, they hand you a file and say, you're going to trial in 15 minutes, and you better know what you're doing. So it was great. I was a public defender about a year and a half, and in that period of time, I tried a lot of felony cases, mostly the jury. I tried a lot of cases because you'd try 2 and 3 cases a week. And we always had juries 2 weeks a month. So we were, and then during the days we didn't have juries, we were trying non-jury trials to the judges. So told a lot of cases. And then, I know what happened. I wanted to get licensed in Missouri. I'd taken the Missouri bar as well, called a friend to see if he would write me a rejection letter.
Why? Wait, why a rejection letter?
Because to be licensed in Missouri, you had to either live there or have a job in the state of Missouri, and I didn't either. But the clerk of the Missouri Supreme Court said, listen, if you have some letters showing that you're looking for work, we'll give you your Missouri license. So I called some friends who were, in fact, old singers who were lawyers at the time and said, please send me a rejection letter. And one of them said, no, we need some lawyers. Come over here and interview for our firm. So I did that.
I was just about to ask, is this legal that you can be telling me this? But it turns out you actually were applying for a job anyway, so it's okay.
Yeah, but I did say to them, send me a rejection letter. And yeah. I said, this is the first time anyone's ever asked for a rejection letter. So I went to work for this law firm and tried a lot of cases again. And we are getting to the part about the judge. And there were no women judges, pretty much south of Springfield, Illinois. And some people came to me, some politicians came to me and said, we'd like you to run for judge.
So was this even on your radar to begin with? It seems like, well, from what I'm hearing, you wanted to go be a backup singer anyway. So I'm
right.
Assuming that becoming a judge wasn't necessarily on your radar because being a practicing lawyer wasn't on your radar. But
right.
Was it ever eventually on your radar?
No. I mean, I was shocked. I knew they were going to appoint a woman judge at some point. And I also knew to be involved politically. I mean, you had to be involved in your community's activity. So I was supporting candidates by helping them. But I was kind of shocked that this person said, we'd like you to run. And it was an opportunity. And that person was a very powerful person. And I knew if he was for me that I would win. But I liked, at this point, though, I liked practicing law in a law firm. I loved the people I was with. I was in a second law firm by now. And I was like, I don't want to do this. And my dad, when I told my dad that that they asked me to run, my father's eyes just twinkled. I mean, he thought this was going to be great. And I thought, oh, gosh. He left the room. My mother looked at me and said, well, I guess you're running for judge now, aren't you? And I said, oh, like, I guess I am. So, oh my goodness, it sounds like Cinderella, there's a lot of hard work in between all that.
What does it mean to be asked to run? I think a lot of people have this idea that it's just kind of your own goodwill inside of you that's like, I want to better the country, I want to run for XYZ. But the more I talk to people, it's more, someone is coming out and giving them this nudge, or it's a political consulting firm or something like that. Is that true? What that person involved in with you? You said it was some powerful person. What does that mean?
That means, he was the chairman of our county board. And they then became our United States Congressman. And it means that these are people who are actively involved in the public conversation. They're involved in government. And so they see who's in government. And they are looking for good people. You know that I do that now. I say to people, you've heard me say it to people, you ought to think about running for judge. Because I see people and I realize they'd really be good in government. So what happens is people approach you and say, have you ever thought about this? You ought to do it. And that's what happened with me. And in Illinois, we have a system whereby half our judges have to run on a political ticket, and they then appoint the other half. So that people have to run, the first half has to run for office. So it's a, you can see people and see if they're going to be good lawyers and good judges, but also if they have the stamina and the physical energy to be in a campaign. Because if they don't have that, they can't do the job. You got to be a lot, you have to be physically really strong to be a judge, because you're working really hard with real, nothing's really fun. I mean, it's a lot of negativity from people's lives. You have to be able to absorb that and to be able to take on all that stuff you hear all day. So, you know, that people come to you and they suggest, and I was like, oh, wow. I mean, maybe I could. Some people think about doing it, but they don't, you know, they don't, they're not nice, or they're got a big head, so other people don't want to run for office.
What do you think, then, is necessary to run for judge? At least from what I hear from a lot of my friends and just active political people in general, is that people don't pay enough attention to the judges running. I think this is true with a lot of elections in general, is that people think so much about the federal elections, right, and the national elections.
Correct.
And we care so
Correct.
Much about the Supreme Court judges, but I think people forget that these cases have to go through their local court systems first. And so now I think people are aware that, oh, we should really be looking into the judges running. But so what do you think then is a misconception or something that people should take into consideration when voting for judges? Like,
first of all, you're so right. One of the most important offices is your school board. People don't come out and vote for their school board, and yet these are the people who are deciding the curriculum and everything for your children. So being involved on a local level is so important, and I hope you keep banging the drums and getting people to make sure they're attuned to that. When you run for judge, however, first of all, in a big county, it's so big, people don't know who you are. But in smaller counties, people know who you are. They see you, they've seen you at church, they see you in the grocery store, they know who you are. And the truth is, every time I've run, people just want to see if you're going to be the kind of person they trust. They never ask me how smart I am. They never ask me what my grades were. They look at you, and they just want to size you up. And doesn't that make sense? Because what they're seeing is, are you a person that I could tell my troubles to? And first of all, you'd listen. And second of all, you'd help me solve it. And that's a people skill that can't be measured by books. So some of the best judges I've met and were people who themselves had been in trouble, who had had trouble with the cops or who had done some hard living in the past, and they really understood the human condition. And they had a wisdom about them that was terrific. So that's what people, my experience has been, that's what people look for. They look for goodness, kindness, wisdom, acceptance, patience. And will you talk to them? You know, are you a highfalutin smart kid, or are you a person who has a heart who will listen to people? And that's kind of hard to test. You can be really smart, but if you have no compassion, you'll be a horrible judge. You just will. You have to understand that people are there because they've messed up. They are not there because they're perfect. That's the whole point. So having a sense of that, and that comes from life experience, and also comes from being on the bench for a while. When you first get on the bench, you're really full of, oh, I know this, I know that. And then it dawns on you don't know very much at all, that you're really there to listen and to try to make good decisions.
Well, you're getting ahead of yourself, so give me one second before we ask about what it's like to actually be on the bench. But was that then how you structured your campaign? What does it even look like to campaign as a judge? Because what are then, like, what are the issues, you know, if you're just supposed to be judging based on the law, right?
Right, right. Well, that's a good point. The first time I became a judge, I didn't run to the public. So I had to ask the judges, the circuit judges who do run to the public, I had to ask them. They vote on the associate judges. So I was an associate judge. I had to go to all those judges and show them my credentials. They got to decide if I would be an associate judge, and associate judges, you know, are kind of like the helper bees, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't run to the public, but the circuit judges hire us. So that was a different kind of, quote, election.
Mm-hmm.
But when you run to the public, you can't talk about issues in Illinois. You do talk about fairness. You can talk about how your system is structured. And you do talk about your credentials and what you bring to the job so that people get a sense of who you are. And they just want to look at you. So you can't say, I'm going to vote a certain way. You can only promise that you'll follow the law and that you'll be fair and impartial. But you going to events and letting people see you and letting people size you up is what it's really about. So they can look at you and they can decide, is this the kind of person I want deciding my life, my money, my kids, my house, my divorce, all the things that are really important to people.
What did it mean for you to be the first female judge? And what I recently learned wasn't just one county, but five counties, because you were the first female judge for that judicial circuit. Yeah.
Right.
Verbiage.
It was daunting. And it was exhilarating and exhausting at the same time. I mean, it was fun. I have to say, it was fun to break a barrier. It was fun to be the first at something. It made my parents incredibly proud. It made my family proud of me, and I was proud of it. It meant that I was the lead-in on the 5, 6, and 10 that night in the St. Louis market. I was the lead-in story because it was a big deal in those days. It was 1985, so there were very few women judges at the time. So, yeah, it was really cool. But it also meant that I had to live my life, you know, under a glass globe. So when you're in public life, everybody knows everything about you. But when you're the first of something in public life, everybody watches you as opposed to just knows things about you. So they actively watch you and they're looking for slip-ups. And, you know, it's just, I knew that everything I did 24 hours a day was being watched closely, and that whatever I did would impact any other woman who ever wanted to be a judge in that part of the state. So that was a lot, I got to say. It was wonderful, but it was also very lonely because there was nobody else doing it, right? There was nobody else to talk to about it. People would come to the courtroom, or they would put their face on the glass on the back door to look at me, see what it looked like to see a woman judge. People would bring me their young daughters to meet me. I got invited so many places because people wanted to see what a woman judge, quote, looked like and how they act. So it was a process of educating the public as well. It was interesting. It was a really interesting time.
And do you think that you felt prepared for that sort of globe-like thing, especially since you mentioned that you were in the second class of women at Notre Dame? I think the ratio at that point, right, was 10 to 1, something crazy like that.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
Was that something that felt new to you, or was it just another thing that you were ready for?
Another thing that I was ready for. Because you're right, having gone to Notre Dame and having done that experience, you just learned to get along with that concept that people were going to ask you questions and people were going to stare at you and people were going to say, you shouldn't be doing this. And you just knew that life was changing for people, and they weren't ready for that change. They would get there, but they just weren't ready at the moment. So I knew in my heart, I'm pretty tough. You know, I'm pretty tough, Mary.
Mm-hmm. Yes, everybody, I do know this, yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty tough. And if you give me something to do, I'll gut it out. I'll grit it out. So I gritted it out. I wasn't fighting cancer, right? I was doing something really great and exciting. So gritting out something great and exciting was a good challenge. Were there lawyers who said their clients didn't want a woman judge? Absolutely. And that became a little troubling once in a while. But I understood where the lawyers were coming from. They had to be honest with me and their clients. And you have to accept that some people are going to say those things. And, you know, now we don't even think about it. We just don't even think about it. But then it was when I sat in divorce court, I had lawyers come back and say, you know, my guy doesn't want you. I said, okay, you can ask for another judge. I mean, why get offended by it? But I was young, too. I was 29. So the combination of being young and a woman, what people, it was just a new time. It was a new time.
And did you feel like because you knew people were watching you and because you knew this was a monumental moment, per se, did you make any goals or expectations for yourself that you wanted to make sure you did or like sought out just prove that you were able to do it, I guess?
You got it. I mean, I never left my house without a suit coat on. I always made sure I looked good. My hair was combed. You wouldn't walk around the block without looking good. When you're in public life in a smaller community and people are watching you, everything you do is being watched. So I knew that, and I knew I really couldn't leave my house without looking put together. The public was paying me. I actively got involved in a number of charities because that was my job as a judge, but I also wanted to make sure I did it as the first woman judge so that people could see it. And then, interestingly, when the second woman judge got appointed, which was about 5 years later, I went to her swearing in. I knew her. I knew her from college. She had actually gone Notre Dame.
Wow. Go us. Go Notre Dame people.
Yeah, go us. I know. Ellen Dauber, great lawyer. I just wept and wept at her swearing in. I was so happy to not be the woman judge. I was so glad that I would have somebody that I didn't have to be that person anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was great.
So then do you think that those first days and that first impression was important for the rest of your tenure on the bench?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the first, you know, the first day I got sworn in, I knew my life had changed. It had changed forever. And that's okay. I accepted that. And I did a lot of it for my parents to make them proud of me. And the first week and the first month were interesting and difficult in many ways. It's difficult just becoming a judge right away because you got to change your brain from being an advocate. But then to know that everyone, lawyers were coming in and sitting in the back rows to see what it was like for a woman on the bench. That I knew I was being watched, but I thought, I can do this. I got to do it. I'm going to do it 1,000%. Whatever it takes, I'm doing it. Extra kindness to the sheriff, the whole spiel. But it was an interesting transition because you have nobody to talk to about it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the hard part. Was I doing the right thing? What was I doing? You know, the whole thing. It was being in a fishbowl alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's social death. It was social death. I mean, what guy's going to ask out a woman judge? What lawyer?
Everybody should do that. Are you kidding me? I mean,
well, nobody did.
Yeah.
I mean, you knew that going into it. So I was single, and it was, whoa. You know, I knew it would get isolating, and of course it did. It got very isolating. Kind of similar to what we're going through now with the coronavirus.
Just so everybody knows, it is March 26th, so we have a timestamp on this. But yeah.
Right, we do. Yeah. So, and it's funny, the law partners I work for, it's a law firm. One of them was so good news, like my father is so great. And he said to me, are you sure you want to do this? And I said, you know, I was like, oh, sure, I want to do it. And he looked at me and said, it's going to be very lonely, Sheila. I have friends who are judges, and it's going to be lonely. And he was right. So that was a process of figuring out. It was, you just jump in the pool and start swimming, sister. That's what it was.
Honestly, I just think people assume that being a judge is what you see on Law & Order SVU, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, like, what does it actually mean to be a judge? What are the day-to-day things? And did you know what to do? Like, did you have a mentor that helped you? I don't even know. I honestly don't know how that would work.
No, they didn't give me a mentor. We were at all. No, you were just on your own. I did know what to do because I'd practiced law. And I'd practiced law in that courthouse. So having been in that courthouse, I knew what the procedures were. I knew a lot of the clerks. One of the things that is not on television are shows about high-volume courtrooms. where you have large numbers of people and you have to get through all of those cases. And that's not even legal. That's just crowd control. Mm-hmm. How are you going to line them up? Are they going to come to the bench? Are they going to go to the clerk first? You know, all that kind of stuff. So you have to sit down with your clerks before you start court. Like, so I got assigned to a very high volume court. We did everything. We did bonds. We did weddings at 2 p.m. And I sat down with the clerk who was in that courtroom at the time and said, tell me how you're running this now. What's working? What's not? Did a lot of listening. And I said to her, you know, I'm here to learn from you too, because you are in it together. I was the one making the decisions, but she was running the paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to listen to her and see, you know, how are we going to serve the public? So every judge does that. You have to listen to the staff that's already there about what physically is happening so we can serve the public. So the first couple days was talking to my clerk. Now, I had a whole court then. She would just show me what we were going to do that. She already knew what the schedule was, and I was making the decisions. And then she and I worked through, you know, what do you want to change? How do you want to do this? And made it a very... because she's in the business of serving the public, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that became interesting, yeah. And then you're always on call. Judges are always on call.
Really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, you're always on call. In bigger counties, they have call duty. In the old days, we had beepers. Now they can use cell phones. But there's always a judge who's on call. And in smaller counties where we're a big, smaller communities, but bigger geographic expanse, you're on call. So if a police officer needs a warrant signed and they can't get a hold of the judge who's on call, they can drive to anybody's house and knock on the door. So you've always got that going on. And that's fun. But you're always ready to do whatever is needed in the county to get the job done, whether it's come in and do bonds at night if they've had a lot of people arrested. And it's a service. You know, it's a service industry, if you think about it. That's what we're there to do. So it works 24 hours a day. It's going on 24 hours a day.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. that makes a lot of sense. And then for folks that don't know what your history was after all of this, she ended up being a state appellate court judge for Illinois. Do you think that your experience with being the first female judge, did it motivate you to do this some more? Or were you, because you talk about how it was hard, you know, and that's not to say that if that's something that people don't want to do, like sometimes things in life are hard and you don't have to battle through everything, right? Like if it's so much of a battle that your mental health is compromised and like you're not living a life, you know, you don't have to continue to battle through that. Like there are other options.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I never felt like that.
Right.
I never felt it was like that. Okay. No, it was not disabling. In fact, it was a wonderful challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard, but it's not digging ditches.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's hard. Or climbing up, being an iron worker and climbing up, you know, shimming up poles. I mean, that's physical hard. It was hard in the sense that it was challenging, not hard. Maybe hard's a bad word. It was a challenge. But it was such a joyful challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an honor. And it's so exhilarating, I think, to be serving your country. It's just exhilarating to give your life over to your country and to the system of justice we have. There wasn't a day that I was a judge that I hated being a judge. I loved every day of it. There were challenges. There were days I hated some of the people I was with. Okay. But, you know, it was a great life. And it was an honor and a privilege every day to do that job. And I'd do it again. It was a heartbeat. I ran for higher office because my brain was dying. I got stuck in a suburban courthouse, which was close to our house, as you recall. You weren't around yet. It was, it didn't have a lot of intellectual cases in it. And I was used to being in a different division every year, where 1 year you did divorces and the next year you did probate. And so your brain was always working. That courthouse didn't do that. They put you in traffic court or something and you were there for, oh my gosh. And your brain just got soft. And I actually said, you know what, I'm either going to run to the appellate court, which was a much more, it's an intellectual court, or I'm going to quit and become a real estate lady. I mean, I'm just so done with
Wait, really?
What I was doing. Oh, yeah. I couldn't take it anymore. I needed an intellectual challenge. It was too rote, and I needed some diversion, and I'd had enough of that. I was either going to go downtown and work in the Daily Center, but you're not in charge of that. The chief judge is in charge of that. In the county I was in downstate, the chief judge moved us around once a year, so everybody had to do the boring stuff, and then the next year you got an interesting courtroom, and then the next year after that you got kind of a boring courtroom. So that your brain didn't go soft. In Cook County, they don't do it that way. You could get stuck in a boring courtroom for years. And I said, yeah, I got to do something. So it was really that made me run for the appellate court. So I got to do something. I'm going to go brain dead here. So I ran for the appellate court.
And do you think your first time, you know, your first days on the bench there were just as pivotal as your first days on the bench downstate? Or do you think it was just a totally different world?
It was a totally different world. First of all, there were other women there. I was the only person in the history of Illinois to have a baby while she was on the appellate court, and that would be you.
Oh, that's me. Yay.
Yes. I'm sorry. I had you before I was on the appellate court.
No.
Yeah, Maureen. Second daughter was the one. Everybody at the appellate court was in their 60s and up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 39 years old. So I was younger by 30 years for a lot of these people. And the appellate court is the opposite of a trial court. Trial court, you got the cops, you got the defendants, you got people screaming at each other. The appellate court, it's all reading, all writing, it's all lawyers. So it was such a different. So I hadn't done a lot of appellate work. So academically and intellectually, I had a lot of catch up to do when I got there. And I had a new baby. That would be you. So it was, oh my gosh, I have a lot to do. I didn't change the system very much, but the system sure changed me. And I just became a better student of the law. And I was a mom then, too. So that had a whole different, you know, whole different feel.
Yeah, but I mean, you had to have changed the system a little bit because you had a child, right?
Well, I was also the only person to have two other babies.
Right.
So, yeah, the appellate court did not have maternity leave back then.
Crazy.
I don't think they still do. In fact, one guy said to me, my colleagues, I asked him if we could not have court on a certain day because I had to go to the doctor, and he said no.
Lovely. They're all so lovely.
Yeah. Oh, so lovely. It was unbelievable, some of the things these men said to me. It was unbelievable. They had never really worked with a judge who was pregnant. So that really put him in a... So the first 100 days on the appellate court were really interesting. Because I was pregnant, and they just thought I was some animal from the creature from the deep.
Which really shouldn't be a surprise to them, because I'm sure they had their own partners that, you know, had their own children.
Not at their office.
Yeah, true.
So it was... Yeah, so... That was a very interesting. I used to say I had a lot of anger towards some of them because of how they treated a woman. But you know, that's the way it goes. It was that way at Notre Dame. It was that way. You got to roll through people's evolving emotions about you doing something that they had never experienced before, and you being the recipient of their discomfort and how the world is changing. You just kind of say, well, that's what it is. I'm here. You have to deal with me.
If you had any lasting words for anyone that was running for office or even anyone who was going to be the first, you know, woman at their job, what would you say?
Don't be afraid. Don't let fear dictate your life. If you want something, you go for it. But letting your fears dictate your agenda is not healthy in any situation. And I'm a very fearful person in the sense that I let fear dictate a lot of what I did when I was younger. But once you get into public life and you realize, or any life, you realize you're capable, you're good at what you do. Once you realize that, don't let fear stop you in whatever it is you're going to do in life. Don't. You too. I say that to you a lot. I know you've heard me say that.
Don't let fear stop you. Go for it. Jump in that pool and do it. Life will be interesting and exciting.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. I think I will admit that I think there are times that I underestimate just how cool my parents are simply because they're my parents and I just want to rebel at all times. So I wholeheartedly appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. I think you're pretty spectacular. So thank you for chatting.
I think you're really spectacular too. And thanks for inviting me on your podcast. It's really cool.
Love you.
Love ya.
Thanks for listening to this episode of First 100 Days. Original music by Dan Chmielinski, and feel free to tell your friends. Bye, y'all.